Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, before we talk to Charlie Pierce, let's talk about our Patreon page at patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. As you may or may not know, the Bob Seska Show is almost entirely fueled by our Patreon subscribers. So if you dig what you hear today, please consider signing up for just $5 a month on our Patreon page. Not only are you going to get access to the Shadow Docket shows twice per week, but you're also going to get to download the Patreon app. You'll be able to comment under each episode, and you can even post your own blogs in the member posts tab as well. Plus, you'll be supporting this fully independent podcast as we guide you through the chaos of our politics. So get going. Again, that's BobSeskaShow.com or Patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. And now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Today's Rachel Maddow Show Award for Headline Excellence goes to Bob Seska.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, November 8, 2023, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 1022 of the Biden-Harris administration, 362 days until the 24th presidential election. You can find me on Threads and Instagram at the Bob Seska, Twitter Bob Seska underscore go, Spoutable Bob Seska, and the Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. So the great Charlie Pierce from Esquire.com and the Stephanie Miller Show returns to the podcast today to discuss the assassination of President Kennedy, coming up on 60 years after that terrible day in Dallas. Charlie's been studying that event since the 1970s and supports the idea that there was, in fact, a conspiracy to murder the president. And guess what? I do too. Now, our theories aren't as ludicrous as some, but on the show today, we'll discuss the various reasons why we believe there was a plot to murder JFK that involved more than just Lee Harvey Oswald. And don't worry, we're also going to talk about the results of this week's elections, too. Meantime, don't forget to support this podcast by subscribing to us on Patreon, BobSeskaShow.com. Okay, here's me and Charlie Pierce discussing the JFK assassination.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
Yeah, you know what? When I scheduled this, I didn't realize that the day before was Election Day and that many of us would be up way too late the night before.
I slept in a little bit this morning. I'm fine.
Oh,
as soon as the Virginia House flipped, I guess.
Yeah.
I went to bed.
So, yeah, before we talk about JFK, I'd love to get your reaction to everything that went down last night. Big effing deal, as Biden once said, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I was enjoying the comeuppance that people got who assumed that the anti-Dobbs energy had run out of gas.
Uh-huh.
Only to have it like come roaring back the first time anybody got a chance to actually vote on it.
Yeah. What is it with the punditry right now and just not giving any wiggle room whatsoever to the Democrats? Even with election after election going the way of the Democrats, they're still linked to this Democrats in disarray. Everything's bad news for Joe Biden, on and on and on. What is that? Why are they doing that?
Well, for one thing, there are Democrats who won't shut up. And this makes me freaking crazy.
Yeah.
You know, the New York Times is not your friend. Don't go you know, giving them wonderful background quotes they can make a story out of.
Who are the Democrats you're talking about? Who are the ones who won't shut up?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's all the ones who are identified as, you know, Democratic strategists or sources close to the administration or, excuse me.
Yeah.
Or, you know, guys who gave Joe Biden an ice cream cone 3 years ago. I mean, it's whoever, you know, whoever will, you know, what little squeaky little chicken shit mothers who don't want to put their name on stuff that go blabbing to the Times and the Post and the TV networks.
Yeah.
To, you know, because they want to seem like they're in the know. The Republicans do not do that. If they go over the cliff, they go over together.
You know, one of the things I've noticed or haven't noticed, Charlie, is the utter lack of leaks coming from the White House saying that Joe Biden's falling asleep in cabinet meetings. The sort of thing we heard in the second term of Ronald Reagan. None of that's happening, right? I mean, I haven't seen any stories along those lines.
No, all of the you know, Biden in trouble stories have come on people commenting on the campaign, not on his performance in office at all.
It's ridiculous. There's no evidence for this as far as his ability to handle the job. I mean, from every indication, he's fully engaged in everything, right?
Right. You know, I mean, I'm sure he's, you know, he's lost a step, as we all will.
Yeah.
You know, when we're, you know, pushing 80, but, you know, he's, the administration seems to be rocking right along.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's,
I mean, there's no major gaffes. They're getting, you know, judges confirmed by the carload.
Yeah.
And all they can, you know, and all they can say is that they, you know, that there are some bad polling numbers a year away from the most shrouded in
yeah,
fog election we've ever had.
And the Republicans are going to keep effing that chicken, aren't they? They're going to keep going like full extremists between now and next year. I mean,
they have absolutely no ideas. They are so bereft of ideas, they have to cling to the ones they have.
Right, right.
You know, and it's terrible because I hear Glenn Youngkin's been on the phone all morning canceling hotel rooms in New Hampshire.
Is that true? Or are you kidding?
No, I am kidding about that, but I'm sure it's, maybe not him, but some of his supporters are. I guarantee you that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I noticed in the past couple of months, Charlie, is, and we're going to get to JFK here in a second, but one of the things I noticed in the past couple of months is Donald Trump's been telling his rally crowds not to vote. That's been one of the greatest hits that he throws into his rallies. Don't vote. Just keep an eye on the other voters. Don't worry about voting. Just look for the election fraud that might damage me is essentially what he's saying. Maybe that's not such a good idea, as we saw last night with voter turnout problems for the Republicans, right?
Well, not only that, but you're leaving the field wide open for angry, motivated Democrats.
Right.
Who are somehow managing not to, you know, tap dance on their own dicks for the first time in you know, generations.
Right, right.
Everybody's pulling on the same oar right now. It's actually quite nice to see. But before we leave the elections, my favorite result last night was Yousef Salam of the exonerated five from Central Park.
Oh, yeah.
Becoming elected to the New York City Council while Donald Trump is under 91 federal indictments.
It is a gorgeous, gorgeous juxtaposition of two stories.
I mean,
Dr.
King turns out to have been right about the arc of the moral universe, although it does take its own damn sweet time.
Yeah.
You know, bending toward justice.
Yeah. I mean, and similar to that, I feel a lot better about the integrity of the average American voter today than I did yesterday. That's for sure.
Well, I feel very, very good about the fact that the Ohio voters were able to see through all the phony, you know, dodges and language games that were played by the people against question one.
Yeah.
And just see right through to the actual issue, which was, do you want this in your state constitution?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is yes, obviously. But yeah. they had they had to live through a year of serious disinformation.
Yeah, and this is further proof that one of the best ways to get around minority rule is to use ballot initiatives and just go right to the people on these things and completely sidestep the Republican state legislatures and governor's mansions, right?
Yeah, I mean, I saw Rick Santorum was on one of the, you know, the right-wing,
yeah,
you know, deli shop TV networks saying that he believes that democracy is better served by states that don't have the initiative process. Yeah, I'll bet you do.
That's right. That's actually the opposite of democracy, Rick. Good God.
I mean, this was an argument that Bob La Follette settled in 1905.
Right.
I will grant you that California's process gets way out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's absolutely true. Well, especially when
when I start seeing signs saying, you know, oppose question 112, I wonder whether or not maybe the system needs a little fine tuning.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, this month marks the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. And, you know, I suppose, Charlie, the best place we can start is...
Wait a minute. That would make me on my upcoming birthday. Oh, God. Go ahead.
Yeah, and this isn't going to make it any better, this question. Where were you when you heard, and what was your immediate reaction?
I remember. I went to grammar school a fair distance from, you know, actually in a different town.
Yeah.
From where I live.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in fifth grade. Sister Kathleen Robert was my teacher, and she got called out of the room, and she didn't come back. Wow. And then a bunch of us got up and we looked out the door, and there was this clump of in the hallway of weeping nuns, 5, 6, 7 of them.
Wow.
And then in a few minutes, the Sister Superior, the de facto principal of my grade school, got on the PA and pretty much sent us all home. So I had to take my, you know, I used to take two buses to get to grammar school. So I took my two buses, but that I vividly remember. And the other thing that I will never forget from that weekend that hardly anybody mentions anymore in terms of like shock value is watching Oswald get killed on live TV.
Yeah, were you watching?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
I mean, we locked in it was the first time that we locked into one of these major events that were also a television extravaganza.
You know, and for your generation, the entire several days between the assassination itself and the coverage of that, plus on through, I guess it was Sunday when Lee Harvey Oswald was shot on television, that entire span of time, that was the first time Americans had viewed anything like that occurring on television.
It was the first time we saw that the networks were willing to blow out their entire schedule.
Yeah.
In order to show one event or the events involved in one event.
Do you think that being able to see something like that happening, and I'll include obviously the coverage that was happening on that Friday after the assassination. Do you think that may have contributed to the idea of maybe we need to know more about this? Do you think there's anything to that, the existence of a visual aspect?
I really do. I mean, yeah. Television was inviting us to be involved in this event.
Yes.
And, you know, okay, we're involved in the event. Now we're not going to stop being involved in the event once it's over.
Mm-hmm.
You asked us in. Now we own part of it.
Yeah. God, that's such a great thought. So from there, what, if anything, started you down the path of maybe questioning the official account of what happened? Was there sort of a timeline for you as far as that goes, beyond just witnessing the horror show on TV?
Well, yeah, I remember reading, I can't remember if it was Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment.
Yeah, it was the first one, I think, yeah.
Yeah, or Josiah Thompson, 6 Seconds in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling it was Mark Lane because Thompson's was a little bit tougher read. And I thought to myself, you know, I don't know enough about this, but this sure seems like it got solved in a hurry.
Yeah.
I mean, what year are we in now? We can't find Jimmy Hoffa. But we could solve the murder of the president of the United States in broad daylight in a day and a half.
And the,
despite the fact that in a day and a half, the accused assassin was dead because he got shot by another guy on TV.
Yeah, see, to me, that's the centerpiece. That's the trigger of the entire conspiracy theory surrounding that. That's the hinky event that took place. And I think to a secondary extent, it's the fact that it was assassination that took place using a high-powered rifle from a distance rather than, I think, every presidential assassination, Lincoln, was it McKinley?
Garfield, yeah. And Garfield. Also, the attempts on both Franklin and Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
Were both pistols.
Right. Up close. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there was already extenuating circumstances even before Lee Harvey Oswald went down at the hands of Jack Ruby. So there are a couple of things that start to trigger that section of your brain that makes you ask questions. And for me, I really jumped in with both feet when many of us did. For me and my generation, it was Oliver Stone's JFK movie. And that started the ball rolling. That's not to say that I believe everything that Oliver Stone wrote into that film. It's just that that was the entry point. That was the thing that started to get.
For me, it was in the late 70s, mid to late 70s.
Yeah.
When I was a senior in college, there was a group of people out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, called the Assassination Information Bureau.
Wow.
In fact, a guy who I would later work with at the Boston Phoenix, Michael Gee, was their director of information. I didn't know that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they brought a bootleg copy of the Zapruder film around to college campuses. I don't know where they got it from.
Wow.
I don't think I even want to know where they got it from. But they brought it to Marquette when I was there. And I went, and watching that, first of all, it's, you know, it's utterly terrifying.
Yeah.
If you don't know what's coming. Mm-hmm. Now everybody knows what's coming, so it's a little bit less scary. But you can't watch that and seriously accept the dogmatic conclusion of the Warren Commission. You can't.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any it's who you're going to believe, us or your lying eyes. And that was the event that permanently sent me down the trail, as did the hearings in of the 1978, you know, House Committee on Assassinations, which opened the door to the question of, wait a minute, how much of this stuff how much of this stuff did people know in advance? You know, what's in the documents? What's, you know, what do we already don't know? You know, at that point it was 20 years afterwards, but you know, it just, you know, and maintaining the, you know, the secrecy over, you know, the documents relating to the assassination for, you know, 150 years or whatever it was. I mean, that to me was bullshit. That's, you know, official Secrets Act stuff.
Yeah.
And so that set me permanently down the path of, we don't know anywhere close to what we need to know about what happened.
Yeah, it's interesting. The people, the adherents of the Warren Report tend to yada, yada, yada House Select Committee investigation, which concluded that there was a conspiracy in Dallas. And the centerpiece of the conclusion of that investigation was the dictaphone tape. And that was actual, I mean, they presented it as audio evidence of what was happening in Dealey Plaza that day. Is this still a valid bit of evidence, or should we write that off? Because I know there's been
I don't know. I think there was some debunking done.
Yeah.
In about 4 or 5 years afterwards about, you know, that it had been some things had been misinterpreted on it. I mean, it can't have been a very, you know, good quality audio tape. I mean, it was a policeman's motorcycle.
No, it's not good quality. I've heard it, and it's staticky, and I couldn't really tell what was going on if I wasn't also looking at a waveform that accompanied the presentation of the audio.
Yeah.
It's hard to know. But they use that as the driving force behind the conclusion that there was a conspiracy in Dallas. But there was other evidence presented, too. And this was a blanket investigation into not only the JFK assassination, but also the RFK assassination and the MLK as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not sure that that was entirely a good idea.
Oh, yeah. Why not?
That's a ton of work for people.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and let's not forget that roughly the same time I saw this presentation from the Assassination Information Bureau in college, I also saw a little movie called Executive Action,
mm-hmm.
which starred Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, Will Gere, and was, let's say there's a conspiracy. Here's how it could have worked. And it was written by Dalton Trumbo, among other things.
Yeah.
And it's occasionally pops up on Turner Classic Movies. And it presents a very plausible scenario on how if you had motivated people with enough money, they could pull this off.
What generally was his theory? What was the...
It was a combination of rogue intelligence guys and Texas oil men. And you know, people who would... you know, planning to make a lot of money on Vietnam. It's not that dissimilar from Oliver Stone, although it doesn't rely at all on, you know, on Jim Garrison, which I thought was Oliver Stone's, the big flaw in Oliver Stone's thing.
Do you not trust Jim Garrison?
No, not as far as I can throw it. Are you kidding?
What is it about Garrison that you don't like?
Well, he went bananas. I mean, he's talking about, he's allegedly hypnotizing witnesses and, I will give him credit for cracking open the door, as much as he did. And for, exploring the very, very hinky relationship between Oswald and Cuban exiles and everything that went on in New Orleans, about which we are still not seeing any of the documents that the CIA has.
Was he on the right track with Clay Shaw?
No, I don't think so. I've never thought so. I think that, given the circles in which Shaw traveled, I mean, he's director of the International Trademark in New Orleans, which was the gateway to the Caribbean. I'm fairly sure he probably knew something about what was going on in the Cuban exile community and may have bankrolled some of it. But in terms of the Kennedy thing, I don't think he built the bridge. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And it turned out later on that he was somehow connected to the CIA, right? I'm not misremembering.
He had done contract work for the CIA, which in 1962 and 1963, it's inevitable that if you were doing international business, you were contacted by the CIA.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just the way things operated back then. And the other thing to remember about this is that at the time, and we're only finding out about this part now,
mm-hmm.
the Kennedy brothers, but specifically John Kennedy, was at war with his own intelligence community.
Oh, yeah. Fired Dulles. Yeah, it was very much hated in the intelligence community.
I mean, it was a rolling ball of snakes.
Yeah.
These are the people who put together the Operation Northwoods memo, which I have held in my hand, by the way. You can hold it in your hand at the Kennedy Library.
Yeah. Just real quick, tell me what the Operation Northwoods memo is. That was the big false flag. Yeah, right?
Yeah, it was a proposal for false flag operations that could be blamed on Castro.
Yeah.
And one of them, by the way, was blowing up John Glenn on the launch pad at Cape Canaveral.
Yeah.
And it got all the way up to McNamara, who turned it off. It got all the way up to the Secretary of Defense before somebody said, this idea is completely batshit nuts, and we're not going to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, and the theory is that Operation Northwoods was turned upon the chief executive, right? That's
one of the theories. That it was going to be used that way.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hartman, of course, has a theory that it was one of the CIA mafia plots to kill Castro, that was eventually turned back on and used to kill Kennedy. And by the way, that's what Robert Kennedy thought. Immediately after the assassination, and probably died believing it.
Do you believe it?
Certainly. I've always concentrated on the fact that I think there were two crimes against America involved here.
Huh.
One is the shooting, and the other is concealing all the evidence, tangential or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, we may never know. I mean, anybody involved in it is dead, probably. You know, the ballistics arguments can go on forever to no good conclusions. But the second one is ongoing, and it's something we should do something about. Every single file involved from the intelligence community involving the assassination and Lee Harvey Oswald and the relationship of all of that together, those should all be released. There's no reason to keep those secret anymore.
Yeah, and of course,
I mean, sources and methods, the sources are all dead. This is, you know, 60 years ago. What are you defending, the reputation in history of, you know, some station chief in Greece or Mexico City?
Yeah.
That's just nuts.
And I think some people who aren't privy to the history of the intelligence community don't have a real appreciation for how lawless parts of the government were in those days pre-Watergate. I mean, that doesn't mean the CIA did it, but it doesn't help either, does it?
No, it doesn't. And the Kennedys weren't, you know, innocents in this whole thing either. I mean, Bobby wasn't too particular about getting rid of Castro, you know, for a long while.
Yeah.
Obviously, I think significantly that changed after Dallas. Because, you know, he sent his own, you know, confidential agents down to Cuba to talk to Castro. And that particular guy came back and told him that Castro was just terrified that it happened because he knew it could be blamed on him. The Russians, by the way, were scared as hell, too. Nikita Khrushchev's son said. It was the Wild West.
Yeah.
I mean, you said lawless, you know, it was also, you know, logicless and reasonless.
Okay. Short break. Back with more Charlie Pierce right after this.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You can't always get a clean you can feel good about inside and out unless you're using Bubble Genius bath and body products. See, Bubble Genius is a woman-owned small business proudly creating our vegan-friendly products in America and supporting other U.S. businesses by buying our ingredients and supplies from them as often as possible. Plus, you'll be hard-pressed to find packaging as recyclable as ours. Visit bubblegenius.com and check out our cause-related items, too, like our global warming soap and a lot more. We donate our proceeds for those items to worthy causes, like organizations combating climate change and mountaintop removal mining. Good stuff like that. We also send our products to the troops overseas through our Buy a Soldier a Shower campaign. Because the least we can do is keep them smiling and smelling great, right? So visit BubbleGenius.com and feel good and clean. Bubble Genius. Doing our part to make the world a better place, one bathtub at a time. That's BubbleGenius.com.
Bob Seska.
Is there one aspect of the murder that's at the core of your theories, Charlie? Is there like one thing that you keep going back to as being the catalyst for your suspicions in terms of the official account of what happened?
Yeah, the gun.
The gun itself, the Mannlicher Carcano.
I couldn't hit. I'm sitting in my recliner in my living room. I couldn't hit the wall across from me with a Carcano. Seriously. I mean, I've talked to too many people who know too much about sniper rifles, who point out that God himself could not do that shooting from that window with that gun. It was preposterous. You know, the whole thing with the gun, I mean, the guy can buy a rifle anywhere in Texas with a phony name.
Yep.
And yet he orders a piece of crap Italian rifle from a mail order house that can be traced to him.
Yeah.
I mean, that isn't exactly tradecraft. And, you know, I mean, from there, you know, if you go and you can go there now, if you go to the Sixth Floor Museum, you can look out the window and say to yourself, you know, why didn't they just shoot him when he was coming directly at the building?
Yes, exactly. He was the motorcade was driving toward Lee Harvey Oswald, directly at him. Right. If it kept going, it would have passed right past that corner. Instead, it made that left-hand turn
He waited until it was behind a tree and moving away from it.
Yeah.
To do a virtually perfect set of shots.
Exactly.
That's the one thing that I keep, that and the fact that nobody has ever given me a convincing motive.
Right.
Why Oswald did it.
So,
you know, supposedly he wanted to, you know, aggrandize himself in history. Well, he denied doing it every chance he got. And he gave about three press conferences before he got shot. I mean, he denied it up and down. He wasn't trying to take credit for it.
If the purchase of the firearm was in and of itself suspicious, where does that put Lee Harvey Oswald in all of this? Do you think he did the shooting and was still involved with a broader conspiracy, or he didn't do the shooting and other shooters set him up to seem like he was doing?
I don't think we'll ever know.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, he passed a paraffin test that would have indicated if he'd fired a gun that day, and the test said he didn't.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. All right. That's, you know, I don't know how much, you know, how far along forensically we were in 1963 about, you know, forensic medicine.
Yeah.
But I don't know that we'll ever get to the bottom of that. I mean, was he involved in some way? Did he get enmeshed in some way? I think that's probably the case. But I don't know. And that's something that's wrapped up in all those documents we can't see.
Right.
Did he shoot the gun? You know, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. That's something I don't think we'll ever know, because anybody who was involved in the actual shooting is dead. I mean, they're gone.
Yeah.
And I don't think they left many breadcrumbs.
Well, usually with murders like this, the assassin tends to want to get credit for doing it. I mean, if I'm going to put myself in this danger,
And that's what they'll tell you was Oswald's motive. Except it runs contrary to everything he did in public after the assassination.
He vocally denied it.
It's not like the guy didn't have press availabilities. They trotted him out like two or three times.
Yeah.
While he was in custody to talk to reporters, you know, to whom he vehemently denied having taken part in the shooting over and over again. And yet somehow once he was dead, you know, they were able to concoct this motive. And, it seemed to, you know, make sense a little, I guess, except that when you went back and looked at the interviews, He didn't, you know, he didn't do what they said he did.
For me, as far as the big trigger that leads me down the path of conspiracy is the neck wound, which every account that I've read from Parkland doctors said that that was an entry wound that they expanded for a trach tube. And if it was an entry wound, that means there had to have been a shooter in front of the motorcade. Maybe it was a second shooter. Maybe it was a third shooter. I have no idea. I couldn't even begin to speculate the vast number of shooters or the limited number of shooters. But the fact that the reports, the immediate reports from Parkland, were that the president was shot from the front in the neck initially. What do you think of that? Because I've heard
There's some doubts about that.
If
you go back and watch the coverage of the day of the assassination, which was, you know, which was the first acid test of TV news. The amount of stuff that gets reported that just goes down the memory hole over the next 3 days. You know, they found a Mauser on the sixth floor of the book depository. The entry wound in the neck. You know, Matt Kilduff at the press conference announcing the president's death, pointing to, you know, the front of his head as the entry for the headshot. All this stuff is right there on video. And it get it sort of just gets, you know, over the next 3 or 4 days, you know, while people were scrambling to put this awful event in context and make some kind of sense out of it, all of that initial reporting goes south, as does the fact that Connolly forever maintains he was hit by a different shot, that he wasn't hit by the bullet that went through the president.
Can we rely on those initial reports, or was it sort of a fog of war kind of thing?
Well, if you're a, you know, a halfway competent homicide detective, you talk to all the witnesses. I mean, the investigation and the autopsy were terrible botches. For whatever reason. I mean, that's obviously the case, you know, and that, you know, leads us down to, well, they, you know, they tinkered with the body before it got to Bethesda and all this other stuff that makes my head hurt. But a lot of people did their jobs very, very badly that day. Too many for me to believe that everybody just woke up that morning and decided to be bad at their jobs. You know, the Secret Service was terrible at their jobs.
Well, they were hungover.
The autopsy doctors at Bethesda were terrible at their jobs. The initial investigation was, you know, terrible, at their jobs. You know, witnesses got witnesses who contradicted, you know, an establishing narrative were simply ignored. Or bullied, or, you know, told they didn't hear what they hear or heard or didn't see what they saw. It was one of the worst murder investigations, I think, in the history of criminal justice. And I think it's the seedbed for everything that came after. It was just, it was so badly botched. And so, there were so many convenient coincidences. That it was bound to set people's imaginations aflame.
Well, yeah, certainly mine, because I feel as though maybe the botched investigation was deliberate. Maybe they slow walked the whole thing and bungled it in order to fabricate an official story that was separate from actually what happened. And so,
yeah, I mean, I will always wonder what would have happened if they had treated the president like any other homicide victim in Dallas and let the Dallas coroner do the autopsy. Because they hustled him out. You know, there was literally a fist fight in the halls of Parkland to get him, to get the body out of the hospital into the limo and off to the airport. I wonder that, but I think one of the most remarkable things about it, Bob, is that polling has consistently, from the day of the Warren Commission release, polling has indicated that a majority of the American people believe that a president of the United States was killed in broad daylight by elements of his own government. And we've gone blithely on like, okay, mm-hmm. you know, we all believe that.
Right. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today, Charlie, were the revelations by this guy, Paul Landis, one of the Secret Service agents in the motorcade that day. There was a Vanity Fair piece. I think he's got a new book out that came out last month. Essentially, he says he found an unaccounted for bullet on top of the back seat of the limo, then placed it on JFK's stretcher at Parkland Hospital. But there's no other account of the existence of this bullet, much less its placement in the limousine or its placement at Parkland. I remember when the Vanity Fair piece first came out, you tweeted that you tend to believe this story. Talk about that. What was it about Paul Landis's account that drew you in?
Well, I mean, it seemed to me that the chain of evidence that he described was pretty clear.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy was a Secret Service agent. He finds a bullet and he puts it in his pocket and he brings, now why he puts it on the stretcher, mm-hmm. I do not know. Why yeah. he doesn't turn it over to, you know, anybody.
Yeah.
You know, is something that I don't think he has a good answer for. And if I were to tweet that again, I would tweet that as a major flaw in the story.
Yeah.
But, you know, if there are other bullets, you know, if there is another bullet, you know, in the car, and I'm not entirely sure about this, Bob, are people saying now that that's the magic bullet?
I don't think so. I want to say this is an additional bullet. I think, wasn't the magic bullet just found on another random stretcher? It was
at
Parkland.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this one, I think, was also pristine. I mean, pristine-ish.
I think Landis accounts it as a miss.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting about that, Charlie? As I said, I first got involved in all of this after the JFK movie came out. And the summer of 1993, I spent every weekend or every chance I could get when it was open at the National Archives going over microfilm. And one of the things I noticed was a picture of the chrome flashing on the inside top of the limousine's front windshield. And there was a very distinct bullet dent in that chrome flashing at the top of the windshield. And in fact, I remember making a drawing of it because you couldn't make Xerox copies or anything of the microfilm. And that's always kind of stuck with me. I think, what made that bullet hole in the flashing on the windshield? What was that? Because
also you've got James Tague, the guy who was standing in the underpass who got hit by a fragment.
Right, right.
Which, by the way, is one of the only reasons we have the single bullet theory, because they had to account for that somehow.
Yeah.
But the main reason we have the single bullet theory is the Zapruder film.
Mm-hmm.
Abraham Zapruder decides to eat lunch at his desk that day. They could say anything.
Yeah, and what we see in that film is pretty stark, although because it is soundless, it's hard to interpret what's happening between the very obvious shots. What happens before frame 313, head wound.
And they go behind a sign.
Yeah, yeah.
And when they come out from behind the sign, the president's obviously been hit in the neck.
Right, and
he's going for the front of his throat, I might add.
Exactly. And there's a cut there, which is either Zapruder stopping shooting, because that's how those Super 8 cameras used to work. You just stop and then it would pick up on the very next frame when you hit start again on the trigger. And so that may have accounted for that gap, or, you know, obviously it stirs up all kinds of conspiracy theories about having interfered with the film itself and cut out.
Zapruder was just shocked at what he was seeing.
Yeah, exactly. Or he was reacting to the sound of a shot going past his head, possibly.
Yeah.
You know, and stopping the shooting, like, what the hell was that? And then starting up again. His poise, Zapruder's poise in that moment, can't be understated. The fact that he kept rolling and rolling and rolling, seemingly as Kennedy's going past him, Kennedy's head explodes right in front of him, and he keeps shooting.
Yeah, until the limo goes out of sight. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. So the big question I have about Paul Landis, going back to that, is which wound the Landis bullet was responsible for, and that's just a big question mark. And you know, asking about whether or not that was the magic bullet, I think that's a good question, because now that I think about it, it could be. I don't know. It's one of those things that I wish was somehow inserted into the official account, but the fact that it isn't in any official account, apparently according to Paul Landis, indicates that it was an extra bullet. It was a bullet in addition to the magic bullet, right?
I mean, that would make sense to me, yeah.
Yeah.
But again, it's something that, you know, should have been investigated by any competent homicide detective. You know, that's the crime scene. You know, you tape off the car and then you go in there and you look for stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, some Secret Service guy walks by and sees a bullet. Where's the cops?
Yeah.
I mean, where are the guys in trench coats from the Dallas PD who are, you know, supposed to take care of, you know, homicide investigations?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day for me, Charlie, this lends more evidence to the analysis that the cover-up actually began at Parkland. Plus, as I said before, there's like a fog of war situation where you've got a lot of people who are in shock and maybe making decisions that they wouldn't otherwise make under normal circumstances. So you combine all those things, and the very existence of this additional bullet lends the conclusion to me that, man, someone took that bullet and did something to it, or something with it. What was that thing, and what did they do?
Well, the other element I think that gets overlooked about the, you know, the chaos at Parkland Hospital is the fact that the Kennedy staff, Dave Powers, Kenny O'Donnell, those guys,
yeah,
they didn't know whether to scratch their butt or wind their watch. I mean, they're in complete shock. They were still dedicated. They weren't going to let anybody, you know, deal with, their slain leader, except them. I mean, I mean, O'Donnell was already blaming Lyndon Johnson for it.
Yeah.
I think that they contributed more than a little to the, you know, the confusion at in the immediate aftermath of the president's death.
Was there
and they certainly were central to hustling the body out of Dallas.
Is there any validity to LBJ at least knowing on some level that something was going to go down in Dallas?
I don't know. That depends on who you talk to. My friend Jim Moore down in Texas will tell you that there is. I haven't read deeply enough in what I consider to be respectable sources to know one way or the other. I do know that, you know, the policy of the United States changed radically, within a few days of it.
Yeah, you know, I have a hard time accepting the LBJ complicity in all of this. However, in the Nixon tapes, Charlie, Richard Nixon repeatedly refers to reopening the quote-unquote Bay of Pigs thing.
It's going to open up the whole Bay of Pigs thing. Yes,
yeah,
I know.
Yeah. Was that code for the assassination?
You'd have to bring H.R. Haldeman back from the dead. Because, you know, that was one of the things on the smoking gun tape.
Yeah.
And, you know, but you think about it, in 1972, what was there about the Bay of Pigs that we didn't already know?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that particular escapade was pretty well autopsied by then. So, I mean, was the whole Bay of Pigs thing, an aggregate term for all the craziness involving the administration and Castro? I mean, I have to think there is. You know, I obviously, we all know that Nixon was in Dallas the night before before the assassination, which may mean nothing. We also know, by the way, that George Herbert Walker Bush is the only person I know who has publicly said he doesn't remember where he was.
Yeah.
When he heard about President Kennedy being shot.
When you mentioned oil tycoons earlier in the discussion here, That's the first name I went to, George H.W. Bush. There's been some theories. I don't know how reputable they are, but there's been some theories connecting George H.W. Bush in a financing sense to what happened in Dallas. Anything to that?
I you ask me, you know, the people who have written the books about it will tell you there is. I mean, the guy did wind up running the CIA.
Right.
So, I mean, I think there's a, I do think, and this is off topic, I do think there's a lot about Poppy Bush's career that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is an international man of mystery in a lot of ways. He's meeting with the Carlyle Group on the morning of 9/11. He's, you know, he can't remember where he was, you know, when JFK was shot. He knows he was somewhere in Texas. I mean, come on. I just told you where I was when the day Kennedy was shot, and I was 10 years old.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't remember something like that? It's like, I don't remember where I was on 9/11. It's just all a blur to me. No one's saying that. It's just crazy. It's a crazy excuse to me. That's what kind of stirs up my suspicion of him, even though I've got no real hardcore evidence that he was involved in some way. But, you know, I mean, it was, again, as I said before, it was a very, very different time. Everything that happened pre-Watergate had a patina of power-drunk madmen lurking behind the scenes. Donald Trump talks a lot about the deep state right now. No idea. The deep state in 1963.
He don't know from nothing about deep states.
Yeah, I mean, the pre-Watergate deep state was beyond anything he could possibly comprehend, I think.
The CIA was contracted with Chicago mobsters to kill Castro.
Right.
And nobody knew about it, except, you know, the people who were supposed to know about it.
Yeah.
Between 1946 and 1963, the intelligence apparatus ran wild.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, originally the CIA was supposed to be an intelligence gathering organization.
Yeah.
It wasn't supposed to have operational components. And that lasted about a year and a half, when the OSS started smuggling the Nazis out of, you know, the Nazi intelligence people out of Germany. I'm perfectly willing to believe there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes in the government we don't know about, but I am not going to say it's worse now than it was in 1962, 1963.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there were crazy people with their fingers on many buttons.
And the name I always go to is Gordon Liddy. Whenever I hear crazy people pre-Watergate, I think of Gordon Liddy as kind of the perfect illustration of exactly what we're talking about.
That and James Jesus Angleton, by the way, who gives their kid the middle name Jesus? I mean, unless you're the Alou family, I mean, who does that?
Yeah, yeah. I guess wrapping this up, Charlie, some folks have asked me since I first announced that we were going to be talking about this, they've asked me why this is even a relevant topic today and why we spend so much time examining the granular details of this tragedy. But in addition to being an immensely rare thing, the murder of the president, it significantly shifted the course of history, didn't it? I mean, that's at the very least, you got to say, you know what, this event changed everything in American life and, to a certain respect, global life.
Well, yeah, I mean, it certainly changed the, you know, it was the beginning of the long disillusionment that ended with that peaked at Watergate.
Yeah, yeah.
That things were in the saddle and controlling mankind. I mean, a lot of people never trusted their government.
Mm-hmm.
After this particular event, and, you know, the government didn't do anything to earn that trust back.
Right.
If anything, its reaction to the event fostered more distrust. I mean, that polling figure on, you know, people who believe that there was a conspiracy that hasn't changed in 60 years is a significant bit of public opinion. I mean, that's, I mean, that's something, I mean, we have learned to live with that. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you learn to live with that is to not believe anything you hear anymore.
Yeah.
And I think we may never get out from under that. If you haven't been to Dealey Plaza, you should go. Because I remember the first time I was there, I was in Dallas on a sports writing trip. And I checked into my hotel over by what was Reunion Arena in the middle of the night. So I just went to bed and pulled the shades. And that morning I opened the shades and my heart stopped because I was looking down at Dealey Plaza.
And oh, wow.
It has not, I mean, everything is still there.
Yeah.
I mean, you can walk. I mean, it's a bit of a tourist trap now, but you know, at the time, you know, I stood behind the fence. I stood on the wall where Abraham Zapruder shot his movie. You know, I went to the sixth floor and looked out the window, and you know, it was so deeply embedded in my psyche that I didn't realize I would have the reaction to actually seeing the place that I did.
What always jumps out to me, and I haven't been there yet, Charlie, I still need to go, but what jumps out to me every time I see either a scale model of it or photography or film, or you can go on, you know, Google Earth and do a street level view and walk through Dealey Plaza that way. The thing that strikes me is the vast number of hiding spots for a sniper that exist in that entire plaza. Like there's a mirror image of Elm Street on the other side of Dealey Plaza. Did it seem to you like it was smaller than you imagined or larger?
It was more compact than I thought it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was, you know, I mean, I was, you know, fairly sure I had an idea of the size of it from, you know, having, you know, seen video of it for however many 20 years or whatever mm-hmm. was before I finally went to Dallas.
Yeah.
But excuse me. But it's an absolutely perfect set piece.
Yeah.
For a triangulated crossfire.
Yep.
You couldn't ask for a better venue. I mean, you know, and if you know, if you go there and you stand behind the fence and you think to yourself, man, if I wanted to kill a president, why wouldn't I stand here?
Right. And that's exactly what I thought of when you said you stood behind the fence. The vantage point.
Yeah, I mean, this is perfect. Yeah. You're under covers. It's a flat, low shot. You probably could even make it with a Carcano. Why wouldn't you have a shooter there? Why wouldn't you be, if you were out to kill the president and aggrandize yourself, why not make it easy for yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Lots of storms.
Why go out of your way to make it hard?
Lots of storm sewers, too, in that plaza.
Don't start. Yeah. No, then we're down the rabbit hole. I will not go to the storm sewers.
Okay.
And I will not go to the Secret Service guy who turned around and accidentally blew his head off.
Which is
another theory.
I read that book.
I'll go so far, but that's it. I want to still be able to see daylight at the top of the rabbit hole.
I'm so there with you. In fact,
against the as the Wizard of Oz said, against the advent of a quick getaway.
Right, right. And in fact, you mentioned earlier the theory that someone altered the body or created a body double or something like that. There's an author named Gaetan Fonzi who has an entire theory about that. You know,
he was an investigator for the House Committee.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got a little cred anyway.
Well, he thinks the body was altered. In fact, one of the images that he uses in his book is the autopsy photo of the back of the president's head, where he says there's some sort of metal device implanted in there. And that's when I kind of envisioned the cheese slipping off his cracker.
A metal device? I mean, like a bullet or
like a clamp or something holding the wound open or something inside the mess that was the back of the president's head in that autopsy photo. And that's one of the centerpieces of his theory, that he noticed some weird shape in there and said, OK, well, that's some sort of metal device that they implanted in there to I don't know, to do something, something, something,
any,
something
any,
your body
any,
was altered.
Yeah. Any theory that contains the word implant, I shy away from.
Yeah.
There is no good place for one of those theories to end.
Well, at the risk of name dropping here, I had the good fortune of spending some time with Ted Sorensen before he died. And of course, I had to ask him.
I met him too. He's a good man.
Yeah, really good man. I was up at his apartment that overlooked Central Park, and I wanted to squat there. I just said, "Can I live here, please?" But for him, that event was the absolute heartbreak of his life. And I think there's a similar sentiment, obviously not to the same extent, but for those of us who are interested in this, that the tragedy of what happened was all of that promise and potential lost in an instant.
Yeah, I mean, it devastated people like Sorensen.
Yeah.
It drove Kenny O'Donnell to drink.
Right.
And he drank himself to death.
Yeah.
You know, being the, you know, hanging around Boston politics, ran for governor once and got stomped. Yeah. I mean, he was a nuts and bolts guy anyway. He wasn't a front man.
Yeah.
But I got to know, excuse me, Dave Powers, who was Kennedy's other, you know, all-time buddy, all-time Boston politics buddy,
yeah,
when he was running the Kennedy Library. And Dave was great. Dave was funny as a fish. I mean, he'd tell stories, but to this, he went to his grave believing that he saw a bullet come from the grassy knoll. He had absolutely no doubt.
Wow.
That he saw and heard a gunshot from in front of the car. And he was a combat vet. I mean, he's one of these guys from World War II.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did
he see a muzzle flash or was it smoke or what did he see exactly?
He heard a crack and he looked up and he said he saw a flash.
Wow.
And he always said that. And then, he would always go on to say, it sounded like somebody had hit a watermelon with a baseball bat.
Oh, my God.
He said that to everybody. I mean, my wife interviewed him once before we were married, and he said that to her. He said that to me. He said it to everybody who interviewed him about it.
And he's not the sort of guy who's seeking attention in any way, right? I mean, he's got some integrity to him.
No, his job was keeping the flame alive. So running the library was a great, job for him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically he was running the library as a front man, but he was, he was the president of the Kennedy Library. All right, my friend.
Yeah, thank you so much, Charlie.
I think we've plumbed the depths. Bring the bathysphere back to the surface.
Yes, I was just going to say, thank you so much, my friend, and good talk today. Appreciate it.
No problem, Bob. Have a good one.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Another shooter's gone out shooting. Today it's breaking news. Another shooter's gone out shooting. They're sending cameras. That's what all the papers say. Politicians making promises, but the guns don't go away. Instead of changing laws, they send thoughts and prayers your way. We'll be right back.
was a long time ago. But it's a different world now. But we just didn't grow. You say that it's your right. Try to tell that to John Doe.
Shooter.